Hello, I'm Caroline Williams in London.
Hello, I'm Ivan Semenek in Boston.
And this is SciPod, the international science podcast from New Scientist magazine.
This week on the June 16th edition of SciPod, The Invisible Right Hand. As the quest for the sterile neutrino nears its dramatic conclusion, we meet the scientist who's leading the chase.
How old is your body? You may be entitled to vote, drive a car, and get served in a pub, but judging by the average age of your cells, maybe you shouldn't be.
How to weigh your head without losing it. Hold your breath, we're answering one of our favorite science questions from The Last Word.
And in science news, never mind dinner and a movie, why treating your date to a migraine may be the surest way to a romantic evening. SciPod, it's not just a podcast, it's fast-acting science relief. You might be forgiven for thinking that physicists already had enough particles to work with. After all, there are 6 quarks and 6 leptons in the standard model of particle physics. And anyway, isn't fundamental physics supposed to make things simpler? Nevertheless, an experiment is now underway that may require us to accept a whole new class of particles called sterile neutrinos. And, as new scientist Valerie Jameson discovers, they could be just what the universe ordered.
So you think you have a hard job? Well, just consider Janet Conrad. She's a particle physicist who splits her time between Columbia University in New York and the Fermi National Accelerator Lab near Chicago. Her mission is to search for sterile neutrinos. These are particles that, by definition, do not interact with any other form of matter. Period. Particles that are literally impossible to detect. And yet, she doesn't seem to mind.
Oh, I actually do like a really good challenge. There's no question about that. And I do love precision experiments, which is how you go after something that has a very, very tiny and only a very tiny effect that you can observe. But in fact, these sterile neutrinos lead to a rather large effect that we can see when they mix with other neutrinos.
Catching sterile neutrinos in the act of mixing is what Conrad and her colleagues have been attempting for the past 3 years. Their experiment is called Miniboon, and it's now just weeks away from providing them with a meaningful result.
We are incredibly excited. It is so much fun. This is the best time in an experiment, when you're actually working toward the answer, but you don't know what the answer is. We do something which is called a blind analysis, which is that we don't actually look right in the signal region. We look all around the signal region, make sure everything looks right. And then in the end, we look in the signal region to find out the yes or no answer. So there's a lot of suspense.
Suspense may not be the first word that comes to mind when you think about particle physics, but the story of sterile neutrinos has all the makings of a classic mystery. It begins in 1930, when Wolfgang Pauli first suggested the existence of neutrinos. Pauli was trying to explain why energy seemed to go missing in certain particle interactions. So he invented a massless, electrically neutral particle that would be responsible for carrying that energy away. It turned out he was right. The neutrino was first detected experimentally in the 1950s, and since then, 3 different types or flavours of neutrinos have been identified as part of the standard model of particle physics. Then a new twist emerged. Alex Kuzenko is a theoretical physicist at the University of California at Los Angeles.
We discovered that neutrinos have masses, and the easiest way to give neutrinos a mass is to assume that there are additional states which don't interact directly with matter particles, but which can give ordinary neutrinos a mass.
Because they don't interact with other particles, these additional neutrino states are called sterile. Of course, it might seem a little too convenient to invent new particles, but remember, it worked for Pauli, and it's an idea that can be tested.
Well, it's actually an interesting thing, because we don't actually look for the sterile neutrino itself. What we do is we look for a side effect that would tell us that the sterile neutrino exists. So what this is a neutrino oscillation experiment. We produce a beam of neutrinos that when it starts out, it's all of one type. And this particular type happens to be called the muon-type neutrino. As the muon-type neutrino travels through space, it actually changes what type it is. And that sounds like a really strange thing. It sounds a lot like a tiger changing its stripes or something like that. And that's actually exactly what's happening. So that later on, when you look at it in a detector further downstream, you see a different kind of particle coming out, an electron-type neutrino. And it turns out that this transition can only happen if we also have sterile neutrinos out there.
What makes this experiment so exciting is not simply that it might tidy up one little corner of the particle zoo. The discovery of sterile neutrinos would have big implications for many problems in physics and cosmology. And at the top of the list has to be dark matter. We know it exists, we just don't know what it is. So if sterile neutrinos are real, then we may finally have the beginnings of an answer to the dark matter problem.
And that's the beauty of it, that you need these states in most models of neutrino masses anyway, so you may just consider that some of them are light enough to be dark matter. So then you look for other clues, and they come from a few other astrophysical phenomena.
One of those phenomena is the formation of stars in the early universe, which may have been accelerated by the presence of sterile neutrinos. Another is the puzzling high speed at which many neutron stars travel through our galaxy. According to Kuzenko, that could be due to recoil from the sudden release of sterile neutrinos. And because sterile neutrinos are expected to decay and produce X-rays, a universe full of them should have a faint X-ray glow.
The average sterile neutrino decays on the time scale, which is many orders of magnitude longer than the age of today's universe. But since you have such a huge amount of them in dark halos surrounding our galaxy and other galaxies, there are enough of these particles to decay and produce some signal.
Today's X-ray telescopes aren't quite sensitive enough to pick up the background glow of decaying sterile neutrinos, if such a glow even exists. Someday, another generation of instruments may finally achieve that. But depending on what happens with the Miniboon experiment, we may not need to wait that long.
Oh, if there's a positive signal, it changes everything, I think. What it means is that we have a very different picture of what's going on in particle physics because we have this extra new particle that hasn't appeared in our theories. And so we have to then start figuring out how to connect this up with what is going on in the larger picture.
The search for sterile neutrinos has always been considered a long shot, but it's a long shot that needs to be thoroughly checked to make progress in any direction. And that's precisely why Janet Conrad has taken on the impossible task of looking for particles that can't be seen. It's to find out if there's an invisible force acting on the universe at large.
And you don't have to split the atom to find out more about sterile neutrinos and the Miniboon experiment. All you have to do is crack open this week's issue of New Scientist magazine.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
The expression young at heart may soon be taking on a new meaning. That's because a Swedish researcher has pioneered a way to determine how frequently cells in different parts of your body replace themselves. This week, New Scientist takes a closer look at this interesting work and how it's changing our concept of the aging process. Gaia Vince is a science journalist and a regular contributor to New Scientist. She spoke with Caroline in London.
So, Gaia, the first question has to be, how old are you?
Well, my birth age is over 30, but my actual age is about 15 and a half.
That sounds too good to be true to me. How come you've actually got away with being half your own age?
Well, it's not some revolutionary cosmetic surgery, you'll be glad to hear. You're the same age as me. We're all about 15 and a half years old, because that's the average age of the cells in our body, and the cells make up us, so So that's our age.
So I've often heard that our body renews itself every 7 years. So is this a kind of similar sort of thing?
Well, up till now, there's been a kind of urban myth that cells renew themselves, or our bodies are completely replaced every 7 years. But people haven't really known because there haven't been any tests on humans. So the latest research shows that it's probably about 15 and a half years on average. So some cells are renewed much, much more often, and some cells are the same age as our birth age.
So this has been something that researchers have been trying to work out for a long time, but haven't actually been able to find out in humans. So why has it been so difficult in the past?
Well, our only studies have been so far on animals, and that's been very frustrating because researchers have wanted to apply this work to humans. The only way to find out the age of cells in animals has been to feed them or to inject them with radioactive nucleotides, little molecules that are radioactive. And then these molecules get absorbed by all the cells in the body. Then the researchers look at the radioactive decay of the molecules in the cells, and that can tell the age and how often the cells are replaced. But obviously it's not ethical to feed humans radioactive nucleotides.
So in this week's New Scientist, you talk about a new technique that's been developed to study this effect in humans. So can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yes, this remarkable man, Jonas Frisson, from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, he wanted to know if brain cells ever are replaced, or if we're born with all the cells in our brain and they just eventually die off. However, he was frustrated, obviously, by the same animal problem. So he tried to think of a way around it. And then he realised in a eureka moment that actually we have been eating nucleotides, we have been eating radioactive and breathing in radioactive substances, because there was this unique moment in history, the Cold War, where there were loads of above ground nuclear tests between 1955 and 1963, which loaded masses of radioactive carbon, carbon-14, tiny, tiny amounts, which you wouldn't notice the effect of generally, but it's enough for these to be taken up by the cells, and then as they decay, we can then tell the age of the cell.
So by looking at when somebody was born and what type of carbon-14 they have in their cells, is it possible to kind of plot them on a chart and say, so this one is this old and another one is maybe a bit younger?
Yes, it is completely possible. And so far he's been using cadavers, because we can't use live people because it involves removing chunks of their cells. And because the amount of carbon-14, even after these nuclear tests, is very low in the environment, you have to take quite a few cells to monitor this effect. And he's been sort of working around the body to find out the age of different organs.
What has he found so far? Do different parts of the body replace themselves at different rates?
Yes, he's found something very interesting. I mean, it was always suspected that cells on the body's front line, so cells experiencing a lot of wear and tear, such as the blood cells, the skin cells, cells in the lining of the gut, where it's very acidic, would need to be replaced very often, some as frequently as every 5 days. But then there are cells that last a lot longer, like, for example, bone cells, which are supposed to last, he found, around 10 years, or cells that make up the gut, not the lining, that's replaced much more frequently, but the actual gut tissue, which last nearly 16 years.
And so he went into this initially, I mean, all these results are sort of interesting to Friesen, but he initially went into this to find out about the brain. So what has he found out about that?
Well, that's the great point of debate, because until recently it was thought that the brain was never, none of the cells in the brain were ever replaced. But then there was an interesting paper that came out in Science in 1999, which suggested that actually the cerebral cortex, the thinking part of the brain, the part involved in reasoning and so on, was actually, there was actually cell generation there. Very exciting paper. No one had been able to repeat the experiment. So he took this on and he looked at it. And so far, unfortunately, he's found that there hasn't been any cell generation there, although he has found regeneration in the hippocampus. Stem cells are dividing. And this is very exciting because this is the area that's affected by diseases like depression or Alzheimer's.
So can these findings be used in any way? Can it help us understand Alzheimer's and depression and help treat them maybe?
Well, I mean, I put that to Frisson because this is very exciting. And at the moment, he said that just the fact that we know so little about cell turnover in the body, like, for example, there's big debate over whether the cardiac muscle in the heart, if that's ever has any regeneration. So I think just learning more detail about which cells regenerate and which don't is immediately a help. And then we can sort of start to look at why certain cells regenerate and why others don't. So, for example, if we can understand a little bit more about fat cells, that might help with obesity, because we still don't know if obesity is caused by fat cells becoming larger and larger or if obesity is caused by fat cells being regenerated, so there are more and more fat cells in the body. And if we could understand that, we could then perhaps figure out ways to reduce that and solve that problem. And not just obesity, things like diabetes, so pancreatic cells, how often are they regenerated?
So what's the next step for Frisson?
Well, he's finishing looking at the rest of the brain. He's done most of it. And then he's going to map the heart and find out the answer to that question. Does the heart muscle cell actually regenerate?
Well, it sounds like there's plenty left to do, but it's always good to know that I'm actually half my own age. So thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks to you, Caroline.
And once again, Gaia Vince's story about how old your body really is can be found in this week's issue of New Scientist. And now it's time for Science News.
The answer to a mystery about planet formation could be in the stars. Astronomers have long wondered why some planets orbiting red dwarf stars are gas giants like Jupiter, while others are smaller planets not much bigger than Earth. These planets ought to be more alike because they formed at a similar distance from similar stars. Now scientists at the Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C. think they may have solved the puzzle by looking to the surrounding stars. Scientists had previously assumed that neighboring stars were simply too far away to have any effect on planet formation. But if one of the neighboring stars happens to be a bright blue giant, its intense ultraviolet radiation could be enough to blow most of the gas out of a planet-forming disk. As a result, only smaller Earth-like planets would form in such a system. Without a blue giant nearby, the gas will remain in the disk, forming Jupiter-like planets instead. We've all reached for the salt shaker before and found the salt grains bunched together and clogging up the holes. It's a minor nuisance for us, but for industries that use millions of tons of salt per year, such as the fertilizer and pharmaceutical industries, the tendency of salt to cake up is an expensive problem. Now scientists in India have found a way to make salt flow better and avoid caking. They did this by changing the shape of the salt grains. Normal grains of salt are cube-shaped, making it easier for them to stack close together and cling to each other. Adding a bit of the amino acid glycine coaxed the individual salt crystals to form a more angular shape called a rhombic dodecahedron. The resulting salt flows much more easily and is less prone to clog up the works. And finally, headaches have stood in the way of many a romantic evening, but migraine headaches actually appear to increase sex drive. Scientists at the Wake Forest School of Medicine in North Carolina measured the sexual desire of 68 young adults using questionnaires. Half of these young adults regularly suffered from common tension headaches, while the other half experienced migraines. Not surprisingly, men ranked 24% higher in sexual desire than women. But women with migraines scored about as high as men. The scientists think that the brain chemical serotonin might be the reason. High levels of serotonin are known to reduce sexual desire, but migraines actually cause serotonin levels to decrease. Lower serotonin could mean greater desire, so some migraine sufferers might find themselves saying, "How about tonight, baby? I have a headache."
We hope you're enjoying this week's episode of SciPod, and we appreciate your feedback. If you've got a comment or question about this week's episode, it's easy to reach us. Just send your message to podcast@newscientist.com. And thanks again for listening.
This week, we're dipping into one of the most popular sections of New Scientist magazine, the Last Word column. It's a place where our readers pose their most intriguing science questions, and others of our readers take their best shots at coming up with the definitive answers. Over 100 of those questions were recently published in the best-selling New Scientist book, Does Anything Eat Wasps? Mick O'Hare is editor of the book and the Last Word column.
Hello, Mick O'Hare. Thank you for joining us today on SciPod.
Hello.
So, Mick, you are the production editor of New Scientist magazine, and that is a position which I imagine involves flying around the world in a Learjet, looking at rare forms of paper on which to print the magazine. Is that, if I more or less got that?
Yeah, that's more or less the job. And then there's some sitting in an office, but I don't worry about that too much.
Right, exactly. Well, we are extremely fortunate that you were able to join us today, because on top of all of the other work that you do for the magazine, you were also the editor of the Last Word column.
I am indeed.
And this is the column where readers ask, or are invited to ask, their most burning, troubling scientific questions, and then other readers respond and answer the questions.
That's exactly right. And as I often tell my colleagues, it's the easiest job on the magazine.
Now, and of course, we've got the amazing Does Anything Eat Wasps book, which is a compilation of some of the best questions. So, Mick, you've chosen one of those questions today. What is the question you were going to pose for us?
It's one of my particular favorites because I was required to help answer it in the end. And it's, how much does a human head weigh? It seems a straightforward question, but how do you answer it?
Exactly. This is one of those questions, you know, the question is easier to ask than the answer is to produce, because I guess the trick here is that the obvious way of weighing the human head is not the desirable way. If you want to weigh your head, you still want to be using your head when you're finished with the weighing.
That's right. It's interesting because we actually had another question in the book was, does it hurt being beheaded? And aside of the fact whether it does or it doesn't, we could have actually used some of those heads to help us answer this question, which is rather unfortunate, I guess. But it's actually a lot easier to ask than it is to answer. And one of the answers that somebody gave us was that you could actually hang somebody upside down, lower them slowly onto a scale while you were x-raying their vertebrae. And when the vertebrae started to move together, then the weight that the scale was registering was the weight of the human head. But obviously, it's so difficult to arrange a situation. They couldn't even hang me upside down in the office because we didn't have the correct equipment.
Right now, I'm trying to picture this. So the suggestion here is that, you know, the subject is suspended upside down, so the head is dangling, and then you lower them onto the scale. And then where does the ultrasound come in?
Well, you need to check the gap between the vertebrae of the neck. And obviously, when they start to close, the person is no longer suspended, but is actually starting to be supported by the scale. And that's the point at which you should take the register of the weight of the head.
Right. It's a tricky thing to do. So what is the easy do-it-yourself solution?
Okay,
to this
question? There's an easier way, which was for me to immerse my head into a bucket of water. Because 1 kilogram of water is the equivalent to 1 liter of water, which is the clever thing about the metric scale. So if I stick my head into a bucket of water and displace X number of liters, then that equates to X number of kilograms for the weight of my head. Fortunately, I'm bald, or baldish, so the hair wouldn't affect the result at all. So I stick my head in the water and see how much water we displace. And we did that in the office. It's really happened.
The fact that I think there's a critical assumption here because, as you say, the volume and a mass of water are related, I guess, through the density of water. So are we essentially telling the public here that your head has the same density as water?
It depends. I'm rather dense, as my wife often tells me. But yeah, humans really are essentially water. Now, we know there's bone and various organs, especially in the human head, but essentially we are water. So we know that we displace a litre of water, we're talking about a kilogram of water or a kilogram of human.
Right. And I guess you could actually allow that, you know, even if the bone is a little bit denser, there are also the sinus passages, which obviously are less dense, so...
Well, it fills with water probably, but if you did open your mouth, there'd be a space there too.
Okay, so now I feel like asking for the drum roll. So you stuck your head in a bucket of water, displacing the water was measured, and so now what is the weight of Mick O'Hare's head?
Mick O'Hare's head was 4.25 kilos, which is rather embarrassing because when other people did it, they seemed to have a smaller head. So I've obviously got a large head, but 4.25 kilograms was my head.
Yes, but you're the production editor for New Scientist.
Yeah, exactly, I need a large head.
You need that big head, it's a big job.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thank you very much, Mick. I feel we've made great headway with this question.
Very good, thank you.
And that's it for this episode of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you'll find in the June the 17th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also this week, Ecopolis. The migration from rural to urban living can be seen in the meteoric rise of megacities. But despite fears that megacities are environmental catastrophes waiting to happen, many experts say they could hold the key to sustainable living for the world's population.
A new treatment involving embryonic stem cells to treat people with acute spinal injuries may undergo clinical trials as early as next year.
And finally, is this the end of civilization as we know it, or just the same old, same old? The collaboration of games developers and the porn industry has led to the first generation of multiplayer online games devoted entirely to sex.
This week's edition of SciPod was brought to you by the staff and contributors of New Scientist magazine and NewScientist.com, which this week included Patrick Barry, Claire Bowles, Rowan Hooper, Valerie Jameson, Graham Lawton, Hazel Muir, and Guy Vince. Our technical production is by Bill Oxley, and our theme music was created and performed by The Damn Neighbors.
John McFarlane is the executive producer of SciPod. I'm Caroline Williams.
And I'm Ivan Semenek. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.